This is your life, episode 86. Hello and welcome to this episode of This Is Your Life. My name is Michael Hyatt, and this is the podcast dedicated to intentional leadership. My goal is to help you live with more passion, work with greater focus, and lead with extraordinary influence. In this episode, I'll be talking about what to do when you feel overwhelmed. Are you feeling like you've got more to do than you can possibly accomplish? When you look at your calendar or your task list, do you feel discouraged? If so, I've got some great news. In this episode, I'm going to share with you 7 steps for reframing your workload and getting done the things that matter most. You can find the outline, the resource links, and a complete transcript in the show notes at michaelhyatt.com/86. I'll be back in a minute with some thoughts on this topic.
If you have something to say or sell in today's noisy world,
now you can get the inspiration, training, and tools you need to increase your influence and impact.
Platform University, a community of like-minded individuals led by one of Forbes magazine's top 50 social media influencers, Michael Hyatt.
Each month, you'll get access to
The Masterclass, where Michael interviews leading platform authorities.
Backstage Pass, a behind-the-scenes look at Michael's own platform business.
Member Makeover, with specific recommendations you can put to work now.
A live Q&A session where you can ask Michael your most burning questions.
And the discussion forum where our members support one another in their common quest.
Hi, this is Ryan Jenkins from ryan-jenkins.com. Participating in the member makeover of Platform University has been a true catalyst in taking my business and platform to a whole new level.
Intrigued? Now it is the time to invest in building your own platform. PlatformUniversity.com.
Over the last few months, it seems like everyone I talk with is feeling overwhelmed. Almost every conversation begins like this. Me, how you doing? Them, crazy busy. Well, I know exactly what they mean because I've responded that way too, and it's even now a busy time for me. But today I was thinking back to perhaps the busiest time in my career, the first few months right after I left Thomas Nelson, almost 3 years ago now. And at that time, I was spending all day, every day, buried in administrative detail, responding to emails, making travel plans, filling out expense reports, you know, that kind of stuff. Ugh. It was the first time in more than a decade that I'd been without an executive assistant. And I'd clearly taken that role for granted, not realizing how much it had freed me up to do what I do best. Well, initially, I decided to power through it, but that didn't work so well. The tennis balls were coming over the net faster than I could hit them. And the volume of my email alone doubled in those first 90 days. And it was just a function of not having anyone to help manage it. Next, I tried to enlist my wife, Gail, to help. Bad idea. She already had a full-time job as a homemaker, a mom, and a counselor to countless women. And after watching her in action those first few months, I had a whole new appreciation for her. But finally, I decided I'd had enough. Something had to give. What I was doing was unsustainable, and I needed to take a different approach if I was going to get my head above water. So I took 7 steps. I've deconstructed those for you here. And my hope is that by sharing what I did, it will give you some hope and some practical steps you can take in dealing with feeling overwhelmed. So here's what I did. Number one, I decided to make a change. Now, I know that sounds almost trivial, but it's essential. Evidently, some people like being overwhelmed. Maybe not you, but maybe somebody you know. Maybe it is you. But some people like being overwhelmed. They wouldn't admit this, of course, but they thrive on stress. Maybe they're addicted to it in a perverse way. Maybe it makes them feel significant or indispensable. They may complain about their workload, but they're unwilling to do things differently. So the first question to ask is this: are you ready for a change? I mean, really, If being overwhelmed is meeting some deep psychological need in you, albeit in an unhealthy way, you're not going to change. You got to get in there under the hood and find out what's making you, what's driving this need to be overwhelmed and to be stressed out. You've got to confront that, and you've got to be willing to make a change. Nothing is possible until you admit that or come to grips with that. Number two, I spent time reviewing the productivity basics. You know, in his book, The 4-Hour Work Week, Tim Ferriss says that the key to productivity is elimination, automation, and delegation. I love this framework. You know, some stuff is just no longer worth doing. We keep doing it for I don't know what, but it's not worth doing. That's the stuff that can be eliminated. Then there's the stuff that can be put on autopilot. This is the stuff that can be automated, especially with all the technology that's available to us today. There's no reason why we have to keep doing some of the same repetitive tasks ourselves. Then most of the rest of it can be handed off. Not everything, but most of it. And this is the stuff that can be delegated. Well, do you know, in your own workload, which activities fall into which category? Well, I want to suggest you download my productivity assessment worksheet, and there's a link in the show notes to do just that. It's a simple Word document, but it has four columns: eliminate, automate, delegate, and do. Well, print it out, keep it at your workstation, and now go through your typical work week, and each time you do something, anything, write it down in one of these four columns. Don't put anything in column four that you can put someplace else. What you want to end up with is a list in column four that are those unique things that you can't eliminate, automate, or delegate, but that you must do. And that leaves me to step three. I identified my three high payoff activities. I asked myself, what is it that only I can do? Where do I add the most value? What is really important as opposed, and this is an important distinction, merely urgent? For me, that's reading or researching, writing, and speaking, in that order. Anything else for me is a waste of what I've been given. It's a waste of my calling. It's a waste of my unique gifts. You've probably heard me, if you've listened to this podcast for any length of time, you've probably heard me quote Dawson Trotman before on this, and he said, "Never do anything of importance that others can or will do when there is so much of importance to be done that others cannot or will not do." That's the key. What are the important things that you and only you can do? What are your high payoff activities? So that's the third step. Step number four, I identified my three biggest productivity sinkholes. Well, this was easy for me. It's these: responding to email, production-related activities like editing my podcast or editing video, even formatting my blog or setting up special pages on my blog, and then meeting with acquaintances who want my advice. And as much as I'd like to do this, I'm drowning and have been drowning in requests for some time. Well, I decided I had to eliminate or at least dramatically reduce these activities in my life. For example, with regard to email, I have a public email address and a private email address. And I recommend that you do the same if you're leading an organization or leading a group of people of any size. And my assistants handle the public email messages from people I don't typically know or who are merely acquaintances. And my private email address is reserved for my family, my close friends, and my teammates. Or with regard to meetings, I only take meetings on Friday. I got this tip from Don Miller, and it's served me well now for almost 3 years. I occasionally take a meeting on another day, but it really interrupts my creative workflow. At the end of the day, my content is the only thing I can do that no one else can do, so that time has to be protected if I'm going to be faithful to my calling and if I'm going to be productive in the work I've been given to do. So what are your productivity sinkholes? What are the things that someone else could do in order to free you up to do the things that only you can do? Step five, I did the math. You know, unfortunately, I had fallen into a common paradigm that a lot of people have, and that is I was thinking that if I could do something, I should do it myself. Well, no, that's actually bad thinking. If you can bill your time at $50 an hour, is it a good investment for you to do tasks that you can hire done for $12 an hour? I don't think so. It's not only bad math, it's bad stewardship. Every time I've hired a virtual assistant, every time I've done the math on my workload and gotten some help and offloaded those tasks that are the least productive for me, I've made more money, I've been more productive, I've had a greater impact. Well, what do you make an hour? Could you be more financially productive if you delegated? Chances are you can. You know, we wouldn't pay people to do the kinds of low-level tasks that we're doing when there are other people out there who are not only exceptional at it, but would be delighted to have the work. I remember having a conversation with Gail not too long ago when we hired a housekeeper. And she was frustrated because she thought, you know, this is something she ought to be able to do. She doesn't really need the help. She's fully capable, able-bodied, all the rest. And I said, yeah, but look, there's certain things that only you can do. You know, spending time with our daughters or our grandkids, you know, those are things that you can't really hire done. Spending quality time with friends or exploring her newfound talent to paint, you know, that's not something she's going to hire done either. So it's a better use of her time, more responsible stewardship for her to hire somebody to help her with the housework. And guess what? It was great for the person that she hired. They were looking for work. They were thrilled to do it. They were very efficient, very good at it, because that's what their focus was. So you've got to really get serious about this whole thing about doing the math if you're going to be more productive and if you're going to stop feeling overwhelmed. Step six, I hired a virtual executive assistant. This is one of the best decisions I ever made. This is what I did as I got started in this new role, and I realized I wasn't ready for a full-time one. I wanted to take this one step at a time, and I thought really before that the only alternative was to hire somebody, you know, as a full-time assistant. I couldn't really justify that. But thankfully, I discovered that there are scores of companies, both offshore and domestic, that specialize in providing virtual assistants for as many hours as you need. Now, I personally use a company called EA Help. They're more expensive than most, but they're also domestic. And the people they hire are thoroughly vetted, thoroughly screened, and their service is second to none. So I have two executive assistants that I hired through EA Help, and they've served me exceptionally well. And with the exception of my daughter, Megan, who works in the business with me, my entire team is virtual. In fact, I have 14 different people who work with me on a regular basis. I have two assistants. I have a bookkeeper, a web developer, a graphic designer, an automated marketing manager, a customer service rep, a booking agent, a copyright and trademark attorney, a videographer, a podcast and audio producer, a transcriptionist, and an overall business consultant. And none of these people are my full-time employees. I just have a piece of each of them. And this is a revolution that's happening in business today, where people are able to create businesses that do 6, 7, 8 figures worth of revenue and have an enormous impact and yet have very small overhead. That's possible with an executive assistant. And the good news is it scales. You can start small and grow as the needs of your business change. And so I'd ask you, have you ever considered hiring a VA? Even if you have a corporate job, even if you're in ministry, even if you have a regular job, have you ever considered hiring someone to just offload those productivity sinkhole tasks? What would it be like if you had somebody who would spend just 5 hours a week, and that's really where I started, 5 hours a week doing nothing but answering or filtering your email or handling snail mail or managing your calendar or booking your travel or something else? What would that be like? Have you ever considered hiring a VA, and what would it make possible if you did? And then step number seven, I schedule the important tasks. You know, what gets calendared gets done. If something's important, if that doesn't make it onto your calendar, you're unlikely to do it. Don't ask me how I know this. But I used to use my calendar only for appointments. Well, now I schedule appointments with myself. So if someone asks me, are you free on such and such a day? I can legitimately say, no, I have another commitment. Now, they don't have to know it's a commitment to me or it's a commitment to some project that I'm working on, but I have a commitment, and that's all they need to know. And I used to think in the past that, you know, I had to justify my decisions, that I had to say yes to everyone, And that's not necessarily the case. You don't have to do that. In fact, if you do that, you're not going to get the important stuff done. So I use a couple of tools as I schedule my research, my writing, and my speaking, but I use a couple of tools to manage my calendar and to really think about my workload. First of all, the ideal week. I've framed up what the perfect week would look like for me if I was in 100% control of my time. And you can learn more about that in episode 81. It's called How to Create More Margin in Your Crazy Busy Life. And I go into detail on that. And I also provide a tool called the Ideal Week that you can use, a spreadsheet, to create your own ideal week. And then another tool I use is called the Annual Time Block. And you can learn more about this in a blog post I wrote called Creating an Annual Time Block. And there's the link to both of those tools, links to both of those tools in the show notes at michaelhyatt.com/86 is in episode 86. But I'm now scheduling my important tasks first, and I'm forcing my productivity sinkholes into small blocks of time. In fact, this very week, as I'm recording this, I'm flying my two virtual assistants to Nashville, where I live, to map out my calendar for the rest of 2014 and 2015. And we're going to do what Stephen Covey recommends when he talks about putting the big rocks in first. We want to get the important things in my calendar for the next 18 months so that time doesn't get grabbed by less important tasks and less important activities. So the goal is to schedule the important tasks so they don't get crowded out by the urgent tasks. How much of your calendar this week is dedicated to high payoff activities? If you're going to conquer that sense of being overwhelmed, if you're going to really move the needle, if you're going to accomplish what matters most, you've got to have more of your calendar dedicated to those high payoff activities that only you can do. So, 7 steps to help you deal with that feeling of being overwhelmed. Just going through the process, I promise, will give you a sense of relief that there's light at the end of the tunnel. So here's a question for you. If you hired a productivity consultant, what would they advise you to do with your workflow first? Be your own consultant before you go hire one, which I think is also a very good idea. But look at your own workflow. If you were hired by you to be a consultant to you, what would you advise yourself to do? You can leave your answer at michaelhyatt.com/86 as in episode 86.
Thinking of starting your own blog but worried that your technical know-how is not up to scratch?
The good news is that starting blogging has never been easier.
Michael shares his knowledge with you free and will show you that 20 minutes is all it takes to have your own blog up and running.
Hi, this is Trevor Torres from DiabetesEvangelist.com. Man, your screencast just took all the stress out of setting up my website. Thanks so much.
Join Michael and follow his quick and easy step-by-step video tutorial at michaelhyatt.com/WordPress Setup at michaelhyatt.com/WordPress Setup.
Take action now and start blogging today.
Now let's turn to our listener Q&A segment. The written questions I'm getting are piling up, so I promised Trevinia, my assistant, that I would start going through some of those in my podcast and addressing them. The first one comes from Levi Pierpont, a 13-year-old listener who sent me a wonderful email. I won't read the whole thing, but he asked one question I want to answer here on the podcast. He wrote, quote, "In your opinion, should I build up a collection of already written articles before I start blogging, or should I just start writing when I start blogging?" That's a great question for anybody to ask, particularly a 13-year-old. Yeah, I recommend that when you start, you ought to build up a bank of articles. They don't have to be too many, but if you could write 5, 6, 7 or so articles and kind of have them in the can, it'll really help you when you get stuck so you don't feel so much pressure that it becomes debilitating. So yes, I would write several. In fact, what I would probably do is go ahead and publish those so that there's an archive so that when people come, there's already content that's there. But try to get ahead of yourself. It's a great practice. The next question comes from Father Anthony Perkins from St. Michael Ukrainian Orthodox Church in Woonsocket, Rhode Island. And he asks, "I'm the priest and rector of a medium-sized parish, about 90 families. I'm a late vocation pastor and have a lot of leadership experience and training in other settings, but not leading and managing volunteers. How is it different? How is it the same? What is the best way to hold volunteers accountable, if at all? The leadership challenges are large, and I could use your help, and I am sure I am not alone." Yes, that question comes up quite frequently. I think I've answered it in some podcasts previously, but I can't remember which one. But regardless, you know, one of the things I often tell people in business is that they need to treat their employees as if they were volunteers. So this is maybe the reverse of what you hope to hear, but it's really the case. I mean, the truth is everybody is a volunteer. Yeah, when you have people in business, they'll show up if you're giving them a paycheck. But just because you have their bodies in a seat, so to speak, doesn't mean you have their hearts in tow. And you really have got to have that if you're going to be effective at leadership. And I think it begins, whether you're in business or in a nonprofit, whether you're talking about a paid staff or a volunteer staff, it really does start with vision. People have to connect the dots. They have to see the why. And if they don't see the why, they're not going to be motivated and they're not going to take their work seriously. But if you can connect their work to a bigger why, and I'm not talking about shaming them or guilting them or, you know, using some kind of negative motivation, but something positive. What is it that you're trying to build there at St. Michael Ukrainian Orthodox Church? What are your goals? Who are you trying to reach? What are you trying to accomplish? What are you trying to build? The more you can connect the dots and help people see that their little actions do feed into the big result and that they're participating in that larger outcome, the more motivated they're going to be. In terms of accountability, I do think you have to hold them accountable. And there are some people that you may have to uninvite to participate if they're not willing to live up to the standard or put in the time or whatever. You know, you're going to get the behavior that you tolerate. I'm not saying you have to be ugly. I'm not saying you have to be mean, but I do think that you have to enforce a standard. And that begins, of course, with you observing or adhering to that standard yourself. You will replicate yourself, both good or bad, based on who you are. And that's why I think it's particularly important for those of us who take leadership seriously to take the leadership of ourselves seriously and to really invest in our own personal development to make sure that we're growing as people, that we're exemplifying or manifesting the values that we say we believe. It makes it much easier to call people to account if we're walking our talk and not just calling people to do something that we're unwilling or unable to do ourselves. Great question. The next question comes from John Seibert, and he asked about the difference between managing and coaching employees. He said, I would be interested in hearing your thoughts on this area, as I would like to shift from being a manager to a coach with my employees. I have some vague notions on this, but need to flesh out exactly what this means so I can become a better leader. Well, the way I've heard it explained, and this helps me, John, and that is we manage the work or we manage projects, but we lead people or we coach people. And those are the distinctions. People don't like to be managed. I hate to be managed. Do you like to be managed? I remember leaving a job back early in my career. I started working for a guy as an associate publisher. He was the publisher of this company, and he insisted on micromanaging everything. I mean, he wanted a report on everything that transpired that day. I think he thought he was being a good manager, but it drove me crazy. After about 6 months, I quit. I didn't want to be managed. I didn't mind being coached. And in many respects, he was a great mentor, but he managed me into the ground and I couldn't handle it. And I left. So to be a coach to people, to be a resource to people, to try to find out what's motivating them, what's driving them, how can I help them get to where they want to be? That's really what a coach does. And at the very least, kind of what I was saying to Father Anthony, you got to paint a vision and then you got to coach people toward that. So I think if you can make that distinction in your mind, it's not everything there is to be said about the difference between management and coaching or mentoring, but at least it will give you the right framework to begin. Next question comes from Marshall Huffman. And he asked, do you have any favorite books or suggested reading on becoming a better communicator? Not necessarily in the public speaking sense, but the one-on-one or small group meeting environment. I've read your blog posts and have found them tremendously helpful, but I'm looking for more. I thought you might have some good resources you could share. Well, there's a sense in which good communication is good communication, whether it's being done from a platform to a large group of people, or being done in the boardroom or the conference room with a smaller group of people, or even one-on-one in an office setting or at Starbucks. You know, you want to be clear. Clarity is certainly a goal that you want to strive for. And this is one of the things I love about the SCORE conference, the SCORE methodology that Ken Davis and I teach, is it really does help you to be clear and helps to make your message memorable. But a book that I would recommend is by John Maxwell called Everyone Communicates, Few Connect, What the Most Effective People Do Differently. And I found that book enormously helpful, and it includes not only public speaking, but all the other speaking opportunities that you'll have as well. So read that. Let me know what you think, Marshall. I think it'll help you. The next question comes from Jeff Wolstenholme, and I hope I haven't butchered his name too badly, but he asks, in my desire to start blogging, I know the biggest difficulty will be my domain name. My hopes would be to use my first name and my last name, but my name is Jeff Wolstenholme. That's the exact reason why my email is jeffwolste@, and he names his email provider. I won't give that. But he says, I've thought about using that, but it's always felt uninspiring. I want to be taken seriously from the start. Would you suggest I try to use a niche name, as you suggested in one of your posts, or should I just go for it with jeffwolstenholme.com and hope it sticks? Thanks ahead of time for the thoughts. Well, I think in this particular case, it might be worth using the shortened version of your name. This is exactly what Gary Vaynerchuk has done. He's done a couple things, but at least his Twitter name is Gary V, at Gary V, V-E-E. That's not his last name, but that's kind of what he goes by. It's a lot easier to use, and it takes up less characters when you're using Twitter as well. So that's why he likes it. It's worked pretty well for him. Another thing Gary does is that whenever he says his name, he always pronounces it with emphasis so that you get it. So he'll always say, he used to do this on his wine podcast, and he would say, you know, I'm Gary Vaynerchuk. So each syllable emphasized so you could get it. So you might need to do that or something fun. I've often thought about this with other people that have difficult names. It'd be fun to do just a little short video on your about page and teach people how to pronounce it. You know, maybe create some kind of association that's unforgettable. But this is an opportunity to be creative so that your name becomes an asset, not a liability, so that people actually can't forget it because it's different and it's not just, you know, John Smith. Well, that's all the time we have for questions this week. If you'd like to ask me a question, go to michaelhyatt.com/question. You can either leave me a voicemail message there or email me with your question. I'm alternating going back and forth between both types. But again, go to michaelhyatt.com/question to leave a message. And I'll be back after the break with my tip of the week.
You have a killer book idea?
The real secret to securing that well-deserved contract is knowing how to write a powerful and compelling book proposal that will leave agents begging to represent you
and publishers eager to sign you.
Michael Hyatt, former chairman and CEO of Thomas Nelson Publishers, New York Times published best-selling author, former literary agent, and publisher, shares his simple and easy-to-follow formula. Writing a winning nonfiction book proposal and writing a winning fiction book proposal are ebooks devoted to authors who are looking to take their book writing journey to an entirely new level. So what are you waiting for? That dream book contract is within your reach. MichaelHyatt.com/book proposal.
MichaelHyatt.com/book proposal.
Each book comes with no questions asked, 100% money back guarantee. So what have you got to lose?
Now let me leave you with one final tip. Recently, I started using a little app. It's very clever. It's called Task Clone, and it automatically moves tasks from my meeting notes to my task management program. Have you ever been in a situation where you're sitting in a meeting, you're taking notes, and inevitably tasks come up that you have to accomplish or that you want to track for somebody else, and so you write them in your notes in some way, and then you struggle to get back to them? Well, I take all my meeting notes in Evernote, and I always identify tasks with a little checkmark box just to the left of it, and Evernote calls these a to-do. Well, in the past, I would then have to go through and manually cut and paste these to Nosby, which is my task management software, and it was tedious but necessary, and occasionally I would miss something that was buried in my Evernote task but didn't make it to my Nosby task management system. Well, now I just add a special tag to the note when I'm done. Then when I sync the note to the cloud, this is the cool part, Task Clone scans the note and it automatically adds any item with a to-do or a checkmark box in front of it to Nosby. And it will even process Nosby email subject line syntax, which I know sounds a little geeky, but this enables me to tag the task with the appropriate project, the context, the due date, etc., and all that gets synced up with Nosby. It's beautiful. Task Clone also supports about 20 task managers, including OmniFocus, Remember the Milk, Basecamp, Asana, etc. So even if you use another task manager, they've got you covered. Very clever little app, very inexpensive, and I love the way that it works. Well, that's it for this episode of This Is Your Life. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please show the love by going to michaelhyatt.com/love and tweeting a link to the show. I'd be ever so grateful, and this will help us get the word out. Thanks also to the following listeners for rating my podcast on iTunes this past week: Royce Phillips, Weston K, and Jeannie Blub. Thanks so much, guys. If you'd like to rate my podcast, you can do so by going to michaelhyatt.com/iTunes. But until next time, remember, your life is a gift. Now go make it count.